Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In January, the New York Times Magazine ran an incredible piece by today's first guest, Megan Stack, called "The Soldiers Came Home Sick. The Government Denied It Was Responsible." U.S. service members and veterans have long insisted that the military's garbage disposal fires and war zones made them ill. Why were their claims stonewalled for so long? Megan Stack reports that according to VA estimates, about 3.5 million military members have been exposed to burn pit smoke since the 1991 U.S. invasion of Iraq. A burn pit is a hole dug in the ground filled with trash, including medical waste, vehicles, and plastics. Then the whole mess is doused with jet fuel and set on fire. Many of the burn pits were operated by KBR. That's the powerful contracting company that won and continues to win billions of dollars in contracts from the Department of Defense. KBR fought a class action lawsuit all the way up to the Supreme Court to avoid paying damages to sickened soldiers. Exposure to these burn pits have been linked to cancers, liver toxicity, skin problems, and respiratory diseases. Despite health complaints and doctors presenting research on their findings over the past 17 years, the Pentagon and the VA have ignored their pleas for help. Rosie Torres, a founder of the advocacy group Burn Pits 360, said members of Congress wouldn't even give them the time of day. Then former Daily Show host Jon Stewart got involved, and the whole staff wants to be at the meeting. So that is what it took to get Republicans to finally support health care and disability benefits for veterans. They needed to be shamed by Jon Stewart. On August 10th, President Biden signed the PACT Act. The legislation passed the Senate 86-11, only days after Republicans tried to block the bill. Military vets and supporters led round-the-clock protests outside of the U.S. Capitol in the week before to put pressure on Republicans to change their votes. The law will expand health care and disability benefits to nearly 3.5 million veterans exposed to burn pits. Today, we will discuss why the government ignored these vets for so long, and then we will find out how these burn pits, bombings, and military occupation continue to impact the health of Iraqi and Afghan civilians. First, we're joined by Megan Stack, a contributing writer for the New York Times and a fellow at the George Washington University School of Media and Public Affairs. Megan Stack has reported from many countries, including Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Mexico. She is the author of two books, including Women's Work, A Personal Reckoning with Labor, Motherhood, and Privilege. Hi, Megan. Thank you so much for joining us. And really, thank you for this magazine piece. I remember reading it in January, and I was just pretty floored by everything that you uncovered. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me and for giving this issue some attention. I really appreciate it.
Well, it has gotten a lot of attention after Jon Stewart got involved, but to go deep, I think, is so important. I just wonder, Megan, given all of the reporting that you have done on this, you have interviewed so many doctors, people who work at the VA, current and former, some on the record, a lot off the record. What are your thoughts that it took Jon Stewart to actually get this bill passed?
You know, it's such a sobering view into how the government works. And, you know, in some ways, it's a very cynical story, if you really think about it, because, you know, I've talked to people, I talked to researchers who were uncovering what they believed firmly based on the evidence of their work were health problems being caused by inhaling the smoke of the burn pits. They were finding a lot of evidence in returning veterans. You know, all of that research was sidelined. There was a lot of suppression of it. There was a lot of downplaying of it. There were, you know, people, I have to say that when I went to the VA and tried to talk through with them why they had reacted in different ways to some of the researchers that I had interviewed, there really wasn't an answer. That was one of the great frustrations of this reporting. I think I kept hoping that I would find somebody within this huge bureaucracy who would say, Well, this was our policy before, and we were basing it on these ideas and these principles. And then afterwards, we saw this new evidence. And so now we're doing something different. And somebody who would just kind of take ownership of the entire trajectory of what had happened to these veterans who had tried to get treatment for the burn pit ailments they were suffering. And I really couldn't find anyone to sort of take it. Nobody would say, I know what happened then because I was there and I understand why we've changed our policies now. And it was just like there really isn't a huge amount of new science that has emerged to explain the complete policy shift that has gone on in the US government. There really isn't, like nothing has emerged that wasn't pretty clear even a decade ago. The only thing that really changed, and I looked for something else that had changed, was that John Stewart had gotten involved and he had kind of started coming to Washington. He has an incredible lobbying team. He has a partner named John Feel, who was on Ground Zero at September 11th and or after September 11th and had lost a foot. And he's been a very active advocate for some of the people, you know, the first responders from September 11th. And so they kind of brought their big operation down and brought it to bear on the burn pit issue. And then all of a sudden things began to happen. And suddenly politicians really wanted to have their name on a piece of burn pit legislation. And suddenly the VA seemed to want to become very helpful. The head of the VA sat down with John Stewart in this really kind of remarkable interview in which John Stewart was also trying to say, like, hey, what changed? And there wasn't really an answer there either. So it does sort of create this question of whether, you know, whether anything actually matters in these issues other than celebrity and political attention and the sort of fear that you may be shamed for not doing something, finally becoming a motivation to act. Because there really wasn't anything else that I saw happen that caused such a radical behavioral shift, which did indeed take place in Washington around this issue.
It's just so sad to read Rosie Torres, for example. Her husband, Leroy Torres, developed respiratory problems in 2008 linked to the burn pits at his army base in Iraq. And to read this quote in your piece from Rosie Torres that, you know, if you said, here's a widow, they would have their staff playing goalie. And then John Stewart walks in and they say, absolutely. And the whole staff wants to be at a meeting. I mean, Megan, I can't think of a better word other than pathetic and shameful that these people are coming in begging to get their loved ones help and members of Congress won't meet with them until John Stewart walks in.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. It's extremely, it's very sobering to see that that's how things work. I think that John Stewart has a particular, I don't know if you want to call it credibility or threat. I think he commands a lot of attention in Washington in part because of what he did for the Ground Zero post September 11th healthcare issue. That issue also was one where they had to come down and they really had to fight and they really had to go office to office to office, trying to advocate, trying to lobby. But it really changed and it really shifted. And I'm sure many of the listeners remember this or remember seeing this viral clip when John Stewart went to Congress and almost nobody came. You know, it was all, like a very like kind of thinly populated chamber, a lot of empty chairs. And he gave this speech that was devastating, where he talked about that, where he said, where are you? These chairs are empty, and talked about the shame of it and talked about the indifference to these people who had gotten sick after September 11th, rescuing the victims. And it was such a devastating moment, and it reflected so poorly and was so sort of nuclear to the people who had not come that day that I think ever since then, he has had a lot of power in Washington because people are kind of scared of him. I really think that. I think there's a certain fear because it's understood that he is respected. He has a big platform and he's very effective in these moments of just turning national sympathies and kind of breaking through to the public in a way that, you know, if you are a lawmaker and you're dependent on people to vote for you, you really don't want that kind of negative exposure. So I think his presence was very important here. I mean, there's no question that it was. And just it's interesting to think about why and what the lesson was from the previous lobbying effort that he undertook.
And also, just to be clear, when we watched this all happen, the vote, when 25 Republicans blocked the measure last month, just to be clear, Democrats, the overwhelming majority of Democrats were in favor of this bill, and it wasn't gaining traction because of Republicans. I mean, if you look at all of the photos with the veterans, you see Chuck Schumer there, Kristen Gillibrand, Nancy Pelosi. I'm sure that some Republicans were involved in the beginning, but when it comes to the final bills, can you just give us a breakdown of how that went down?
Well, it is true. And it's interesting because if you think about sort of how the two parties like to present themselves, of course, there's always this eagerness for Republicans to be pro-military and to sort of, you know, at least kind of drape themselves in that kind of, you know, the sort of appearance of being very much support our troops, go military. It is true that when it came down to the vote, Republicans voted against the bill. You know, I think that had to do, you know, it was, I'm not a congressional reporter. I understand that there were ins and outs that had to do with, you know, other things that they didn't want that were happening. You know, it was, I just think in Congress, they get into these sort of, obviously they get into these like destructive battles of politics where the issues end up getting lost or just kind of thrown by the wayside. I think it was one of those situations, but I mean, just, yes, when it came down to it, Republicans did try to block this bill. They did try to prevent these veterans from getting the health care that they needed and that they need as a result of their service in foreign wars. So, yeah, that happened. There's justifications and stories behind it, but when it actually happened, that is what happened.
Right. Today, we're speaking with Megan Stack, who wrote an incredible piece in the New York Times Magazine called "The Soldiers Came Home Sick. The Government Denied It Was Responsible." So let's dive into some of your findings. There's just so many. First off, let's talk about these burn pits. Again, it's a hole dug in the ground filled with trash, medical waste, vehicles, and plastics. But you can't really visualize it until you see the photos, Megan. And can you just describe, it looks like a huge hole because there's so much smoke coming out of these holes. And you can only imagine what it's like to inhale that smoke.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the term burn pit actually encompasses a pretty broad range of fires. So The ones that you tend to see in the photographs are the most dramatic. They're the biggest ones that were lit at the biggest bases. You know, if you people who've had experience in these war zones understand that, like, you have sort of big forward operating bases where there are just lots. They're almost like small cities. You know, you have these like enormous bases. And then as you move further out into the territory where the war is being fought, you tend to have smaller presences, smaller bases. I think, you know, technically, any time that garbage is burned in a hole in the ground, which is done routinely on bases large and small, that is a burn pit. But the ones that we see, the ones that really did seem to cause these huge clusters of health problems. If I went to Rosie Torres's house in Texas, and she has amazing files. She's been spending years and years documenting everybody and what their different ailments were and where they were deployed and what years they were deployed. And that was really important record keeping for her to do, because at the time the government was not keeping those records and was not doing kind of looking for those patterns and correlations. I believe they're trying to do it now, but it wasn't done during the relevant time window. So anyway, when you look at her records, you see that there's certain bases that just created huge numbers of health problems. One of them is Camp Anaconda, it was called at the time. It was in Iraq. That's actually where Beau Biden served. That's also where Leroy Torres served, and many, many other people who went on to have very serious health problems upon return. So when you look at these fires and at a large base like that, you have to understand that it's basically like a small town that has all this stuff in it, right? There's like clinics, and sometimes there's prisons, and there's recreation centers, and there's sleeping quarters, and there's big mess halls and all that stuff. And of course, offices and sort of computers and equipment. And all of the waste that gets generated, whether it's like a broken piece of equipment or it's like medical waste or it's food waste or it's plastic, it would just get taken out and just thrown in this pit. And they would throw the jet fuel on it and just set it on fire. And some of those burn pits were acres long, you know, like football field sized fires that would just burn around the clock because there was so much waste getting generated. It's incredible that that was done. And I always think about, and I believe you have a guest coming up next. I mean, we have had a lot of investigation into the effect on the troops who were deployed there and the diplomats and people who went through. But you always think that this was also done in a, you know, in the context of a foreign occupation and a hostile occupation. And there were civilians and people all around those bases who were also getting exposed to that smoke. And, you know, we hear very little in our sort of U.S. bubble about all of those health problems, which I'm sure are rampant, you know. And so it really was a very wild thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. I wondered that when this got so much attention here, what about the Iraqis? What about the Afghans? And we are going to talk about that in the second half of the show. Megan, it was very interesting to learn in your piece that many of these burn pits were operated by KBR. This is a very powerful contracting company, as you write about. At the time of the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, KBR was a wholly owned subsidiary of the multinational conglomerate Halliburton, which was run by Dick Cheney until he ran for vice president. You report that when the U.S. invaded Iraq, KBR received a no-bid contract capped at $7 billion to rebuild Iraq's oil infrastructure, and the company won a number of contracts to provide logistical services in Iraq and Afghanistan, including trash disposal. So can you talk a little bit about KBR's role in all of this and how they managed these burn pits?
Well, the reality is that KBR was running a lot of these burn pits. That was part of the contract that they had won. They, you know, there are different, then it gets into sort of like anecdotally where it was done. The thing that is, you know, there were different bases where there were different critiques. I spoke with one commander. It's in the piece. I think it's in the Times Magazine piece. And he talked about trying to sort of persuade the KBR guys to haul the trash off site, or, you know, isn't there some other way we can get rid of it? Because we're all getting sick, breathing this smoke. And they were sort of basically saying no. The thing that happened, though, is that there was an effort to hold KBR responsible for some of the health damages. There was a class action lawsuit. It went through the courts for years. And in the end, the Supreme Court did rule, they did accept the military's argument that, or the KBR's argument rather, with the support of a lot of generals and people from the military, that they were basically acting as an arm of the military, as part of the command structure of the military. So you can't sue the U.S. military for things that are done in a war zone. It's a principle of law in the U.S. That immunity got spread onto KBR through that Supreme Court finding. So the thing about it is that it is true that KBR was in many ways quite responsible, but they have argued successfully that they actually weren't responsible, that they were only following orders and that they can't be held to account for the damages of the burn pits. But that, you know, that wasn't necessarily clear. And I'm not sure, you know, I feel like this is an area of law that will continue to get argued and settled, because, you know, I don't think it's so clear to a lot of legal scholars that a contractor would necessarily get that kind of protection. Because the thing is, when the military has that protection, there are ways, you know, if the military engages in malfeasance, there are ways that they can be brought to justice through internal systems of justice. If you have KBR in a war zone, and they are not liable to sort of regular law, but they're also not, you know, they're also not liable to military law, then it's not really clear how, you know, what kind of constraints they actually have on the things that they do, which seems like a, maybe a status quo that can't necessarily stand. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but this is why I talked to a bunch of lawyers about this issue. And there's a lot of consternation around it. And there's a sense that it's not, you know, that that argument isn't over yet, but that's where we are right now.
There's another very important point in your piece. You write, it's impossible to talk about the dynamic between the government and its contractors without acknowledging a broader reality. The personal relationships and professional crossover between military commanders and the companies that dangle a lucrative retirement for high-ranking officers looking to cash in on their experience. You have a number of examples here. Would you like to share one? Maybe Carrie Baker or Chris Heinrich?
I think that one of the clearer things that to me, the thing that I always remember, yeah, you're right. There are a lot of examples in the piece. The one that I always remember and think about most starkly is that when KBR was being sued by a large group of veterans who were experiencing health problems and huge problems because they didn't have the resources to pay for the medical care they needed. And they were trying to sue KBR and trying to find some way to hold somebody responsible for what had happened to them. That basically at a time when KBR was being sued by veterans, General Sanchez, who had been the top military commander in Iraq for a period of time early on in after the U.S. invasion, actually testified on behalf of KBR and his testimony was quite important for how the sort of KBR eventually was able to sidestep some of this responsibility. So you can see that there is this kind of compromise, that there is just, and what he was talking about was sort of how he would work everything out informally with his, you know, I think he called them his buddies at KBR or his buddy. And, you know, the reality is there is a huge amount of crossover between the Pentagon and these defense contractors. And so that, of course, you know, it is, how can I say it without without crossing lines? It casts question over how much fairness there may be on behalf of the veterans themselves. Let's say that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And the piece lays this out so well, focusing on KBR and then learning that, gosh, Dr. Miller, he has a pulmonology clinic. And in 2004, the year after Baghdad fell to the invading U.S. forces, he started seeing patients, active duty patients who came back with respiratory ailments. So to think that a doctor was chronicling this in 2004 and then contacted doctors at Walter Reed, we don't have time to talk about that, but I hope people will read the piece. Gosh, 2004. And here we are, 2022, Megan. It took this long for the bill to pass. I can't even imagine what these veterans and their families are thinking now that, again, it bears repeating. It took John Stewart to get this bill passed while these people were really suffering. Have you talked to Rosie Torres again or any of the other veterans and their loved ones since the bill passed?
Yeah. I mean, I'm in touch with Rosie Torres. I get notes from her periodically and I know she's very happy. I think it's hard. I think, you know, the problem is someone like Rosie Torres, who has been fighting this battle for so long, you know, there are dead bodies on the trail behind her. There are people that she knew, that she was very close with, that she fought with politically for years. I mean, as comrades in arms in this cause, and they didn't survive to see this happen. Their families didn't get the relief in time. They sort of died still thinking that they were forgotten and nobody really cared, which was for so long and for so many years, the prevailing mood of these people. So, I know that Rosie and Leroy are very happy and very gratified that they finally did get some progress on behalf of so many veterans. But I also know that there's a lot of sadness. It's not, I don't think for them, it's ever going to be like a clean victory because they just, you know, they've seen too much, you know, right. they saw some really awful things.
Well, Megan, again, thank you for your incredible report. it's just really, it's so important to learn about what happened behind the scenes, and you do such an amazing job. Megan Stack is a contributing writer for the New York Times, and I hope you can take the time to read her New York Times Magazine piece called "The Soldiers Came Home Sick, The Government Denied It Was Responsible." You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Megan.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Coming up after a break, we will talk about how burn pits, bombings, and military occupation still are impacting the health of Iraqi and Afghan civilians. While burn pits are no longer active, they continue to have long-term effects. So where is the health justice for Iraqis and Afghans? We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about how toxic burn pits have impacted Afghan and Iraqi civilians who are still living with the consequences of the U.S. invasions. Though U.S. veterans will now have access to the care they need from the VA, Iraqi and Afghan civilians will not reap those benefits, despite enduring the toxic legacy of burn pits for years to come. Today, we're joined by Dr. Kali Rubai, assistant professor of anthropology at Purdue University. Her research focuses on structural violence, anti-colonial feminism, health justice, and the ecological impacts and toxic legacy of invasions and occupations. Dr. Kali Rubai was recently in Fallujah studying the effects of burn pits, bombings, displacement, and military occupation. While burn pits are no longer active, they continue to have long-term effects. She says this is not about burn pits. This is about health justice. Hi, Dr. Rubai. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be with you all.
Well, it's an honor to have you. I just have to ask you, you know, after talking with Megan Stack, and thinking about how long it has taken for the United States to provide health care to veterans, to think that it took John Stewart to get this attention. I mean, I'm sorry to be cynical. If the United States does not care about its own veterans, I mean, will we ever see justice from the United States to provide any sort of health care to Iraqis and Afghans?
It's unlikely. I don't think that should stop us from trying. Right. Certainly, this could have been a joint struggle from the beginning. Mm-hmm. But now that there has been a victory among veterans, I would anticipate that health justice advocates would be reaching out to Iraqis who are doing a lot of work to survive with limited infrastructure, and would certainly welcome transnational solidarity, which is always necessary in these big environmental health crises where multinational corporations are involved. It requires cooperation and reaching out to one another. So I think the campaign for justice can certainly be victorious in a lot of ways. Whether that actually means the U.S. is providing reparations for the massive amount of damage in Iraq since the 90s and even earlier, I have doubts that that's possible. But nonetheless, I think it's necessary to try.
And I should correct myself. I shouldn't say the United States. I should say given the fact that this was legislation, it was the Republicans who constantly stopped this bill almost until the very end, but they had to be shamed into voting for it. Because this got so much attention, Kali, when John Stewart was shaming the Republican Party, given that you have done so much work on this issue, were you called by many media outlets to take a step further to find out how all of this was affecting Iraqis and Afghans?
Some, yes, absolutely. I certainly was getting calls even during my time in Fallujah, which was before the PACT Act was passed. From the Iraqi perspective, you know, Democrats and Republicans are certainly equally responsible for the many, many decades of military violation that have happened under both kinds of administrations. And I think that the campaign for health justice in Iraq is inclusive of the many children who were killed under sanctions, the many kinds of toxification that come from heavy metals that were dropped in the 90s, and burn pits, to some extent, are a drop in the bucket. So there are many, many scholars all over the world who are interested in understanding the health effects of militarism more broadly, whether that's deregulating privatized industry in a country or dropping heavy metals, explosives, burning dioxin. So I think that there is a lot of interest from a lot of places. The U.S. interest in Iraq is certainly one that's oriented towards understanding the relationship between veteran experience and Iraqi experience, which is certainly a narrow approach, but nonetheless important to cover.
Can you talk about the research that you did? You were with a team of doctors, epidemiologists, and environmental activists to study birth defects and health impacts of long-term exposure to military occupation. I mean, we talk about the burn pits, but also just the bombings, the displacement. You've got some harrowing stories, Dr. Rubai, that you came home with. Would you like to tell us a few? Maybe first start with Haj Ali, who you met in 2021.
Sure. So just to back up a bit, the whole point of this research project was that in 2004, which I know that Megan had mentioned, doctors noticing veterans with health problems. In 2004, Fallujah Hospital started noticing a lot of children being born with not only more in quantity, more birth defects, but also a wider variety of peculiar birth defects, congenital anomalies that include everything from being born with one eye to many different organs outside of the body, anencephaly, hydrocephaly, meaning no brain or water on the brain, and spina bifida and heart defects. And so these doctors started sounding the alarm and started cataloging the damage over the last, decade and a half. And the incidence of birth defects, while noticeable and certainly dramatic and draws a lot of visual attention, it was by no means the only rise in major health effects from the detritus of war and from ongoing warfare. And so this call for deeper research into the various environmental factors that are affecting people's health has been a long-standing call that's centered from Fallujah and from doctors in Baghdad who really are looking for international research solidarity to support the case that veterans are no longer having to prove. The burden of proof remains on Iraqi people to show that U.S. occupation is causing health effects, something that the PACT Act removes using the precautionary principle and creating a space for the presumptive diagnosis that probably burn pits affected your health, we'll go ahead and treat it. Probably war affected Iraqi health, we will go ahead and treat it. So that's the basis of this research, is that it's in a joint effort to understand the underlying causes of harm. And while I was in Fallujah and outside of Fallujah in various neighborhoods, near burn pits and near bomb sites, it became apparent that the birth defect stories that I thought I was looking for, which were human, were eclipsed by the sheer quantity of farmers who had stories about their livestock being born with congenital anomalies in the wake of burn pit exposure. And Haj Ali is a pseudonym for one of the farmers I met who showed me around his farm. He had a long-standing relationship with one of the biggest burn pits in Iraq near the Balad Air Base. And when it was most active, he noticed different kinds of smoke. It created its own weather. And it affected his trees and his growing, his plant crops. But he also started noticing that his cows and chickens were getting sick. And this is someone whose livelihood depends on having healthy cattle to sell for meat or milk, and also healthy chickens to sell for eggs or meat. And over the course of the last decade, even though burn pits have been closed, that burn pit in particular has been closed for a while, his animals are still sick. And he's really clever. He's a scientist of his own right. And so he thought, maybe it's the land. He got rid of all of his livestock, and then he bought new livestock. He brought new animals in. And within a period of a year living on the land, they got sick again. And his theory is that they're eating soil, breathing air, and drinking water that's been affected permanently by the burn pits. This is a man who had 52 cows, and now he only has two. And I actually got to see the body of the last baby that was born from this calf that was born with no limbs, and it died very quickly. And in order to save money, he has stuffed that baby's body, the skin, and turned it into a stuffed animal, essentially, so that his cow can smell the baby and continue to produce milk, so he doesn't have to breed her again. These are the kind of survival conditions that people are managing while the long-term effects of burn pits are rippling through their land.
Wow. This is devastating. Dr. Kali Rubai is assistant professor of anthropology at Purdue University. She was recently in Fallujah studying the effects of burn pits, bombings, displacement, and military occupation. Can we go back to birth defects in babies for a moment? Because Dr. Rubai, I'm sure you're familiar with this Facebook page called Birth Defects in Fallujah. Yes. I mean, it's absolutely horrific. Looking at this right now, just on August 23rd, there's a post that says, born yesterday in our hospital with multiple congenital anomalies, and just horrific photos of a baby, graphic photos. And then another one, female born with hydrocephalus yesterday in our hospital, no previous family history of any congenital anomaly. The head of this baby is just so much bigger than the body of the baby. What is hydrocephalus?
Yeah, it's great. Hydrocephaly and anencephaly are two of the birth defects that I have been tracking with my research team because they're lethal. Hydrocephaly is a sort of like a sack of water on the brain, often accompanied by other birth defects. And anencephaly is when a child has a face but no head. Many of the congenital anomalies are complex and multiple, which is unusual. And of course, these are what you're seeing on the website are families who've given permission. You can imagine how many families haven't, and the sheer quantity of children that are coming in every day. I noticed, you get accustomed to the rate of dismemberment because that's what we're looking at here. We're looking at the bodies of the next generation of Iraqis being dismembered by the long-term effects of war. And I did work both in a case group. Case control studies require you to spend time with people who have a medical problem and people who don't have the medical problem. And Fallujah is the case location. So I'm in a hospital often meeting families. And just by being in the neonatal ward, I see daily many children with birth defects. And then I and my research partner, Jeffrey Quarshi, we went to a control city and we were in a hospital. And there, I kept looking. I was like, where are all the sick babies? Because all the babies were healthy. And I think what it said to me, without any kind of data analysis necessary, is that there's such an obvious problem that it you can't be in Fallujah without encountering children with these severe medical problems. Some survive and some don't. And the research that's necessary to demonstrate what it's caused by is important. It has legal implications. It has public health implications. But what we can say is it's very clear that the places that were the most heavily bombed, places that were the location of burn pits and military waste and long-term extensive war exposure, are seeing a lot of different medical crises, the most visible of which, of course, are these babies. Mm.
A few more examples. July 2nd, Club Feet. Her twin died on her second birthday, born the last week in our hospital. It's just so sad. The feet are basically pointing toward each other. And then the Birth Defects in Fallujah page posted a report from the BBC in 2010 showing a little girl with six fingers on each hand, six toes on each hand. The BBC reported that officials back then were advising women not to have children at all.
Absolutely. The problem is so extensive that, in fact, there is an entire committee that has been formed to help determine the viability of abortion, late-term abortion for women in the hospitals. Because after 2004, there were so many women who are finding out at their fourth month of pregnancy that their child is in pain, not going to live, as a severe, non-viable medical problem. And this is so extensive that it has produced entire institutional bodies to contend with this problem. So not only are women who have many, many, many tries that end, you know, many attempts at pregnancy that end in miscarriage or death or perhaps a child who lives for 1 or 2 hours, some of those women have been advised not to have children. And there has also been a public health effort often promoted by the mosques when there is a big battle, which there have been many in Fallujah, especially, not to conceive children after a certain period of time. I have certainly noticed anecdotally that many of the children who were born with birth defects had parents who returned very early after bombings. And those families were repairing homes that had been bombed, handling the heavy metals and other detritus of war, breathing the smoke. So there's certainly in a public advisory to be cautious about what conception can look like in the wake of war. And of course, these are families who are deeply invested in producing the next generation of life, whether that's animal, plant, or human life on a landscape. They are actively repairing the Iraqi landscape in every way they can. And they certainly deserve as much legal recourse and of course, financial and institutional support as they can get.
Today, we're joined by Dr. Kali Rubai, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at Purdue University. She was recently in Fallujah, Iraq, studying the effects of burn pits, bombings, displacement, and military occupation. And you can find links to her work, as well as a link to the Birth Defects in Fallujah Facebook page. It's really hard to see, but I think everyone needs to see this, because this is the effect of war and occupation. Dr. Rubai, you were on NPR recently, and you said something that I think is so important to remember, that in 2004, 74% of Fallujah was leveled. I mean, I remember I was hosting this show, and we had a weekly open line to Iraq, and we had Iraqis on the show every single week to find out what they were dealing with. And I remember what happened in Fallujah. It was absolutely horrific. You said, think about what that means. No electricity, no hospital, injury, death, so much pollution released into the air. In fact, you said when you were living in Fallujah just recently, your water was brown. It's still undrinkable. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. War is about breaking things into pieces, societies, buildings, infrastructure, even history. And there is no way to fully recover from the irreparable damage that warfare has produced in a city like Fallujah. But, of course, people are actively trying to repair what they can. And my research and my book is about counter-resurgency. In other words, the prevention of the capacity for people to recover. You know, we all know what it means to take a hit. But if we aren't able to recover from that hit and then we get another, it becomes more permanently devastating. The infrastructural damage in Iraq and this destruction of the healthcare system in particular means that healthcare issues like COVID, for example, or the mass death of fish that have happened because of bacterial increase in the water supply, cholera outbreaks, or something like birth defects and cancer, all of these health problems are terrible and violent, but they don't have to be as lethal as they are. If you have devastated the medical infrastructure that allows people to contend with the hits they take to their bodies, then those problems become lethal. So, you know, this is not new. Many doctors from Iraq had to live through sanctions and watch children suffocate to death because inhalers were not allowed into the country. So there are many ways that these kinds of violences can be implemented. It doesn't have to be bombing a building. Fallujah still has, you know, of course, these 74%, 80%, these numbers are a bit random because you're watching the leveling of a city. But Fallujah now has some repair going on. There's the main road has been repaved. Many new buildings have gone up, but many buildings remain in rubble. So you will often walk by sites of rubble, that buildings that have collapsed, and they stay there. And they're, of course, emitting dust, and whatever bomb was dropped on them is still there. So there is an ongoing and perpetual permeation of the detritus of war into people's daily lives. People are breathing it, they're eating it, they're drinking it. And there has been almost no international repair efforts, and very minimal repair efforts have been made to fix the public infrastructure. Meanwhile, we're watching the private industry, the extractive industries, shopping malls, concrete factories go up at a rapid pace. So there's certainly been a reallocation of priorities from public health to private profit in Iraq.
The way that you say it, I think, is just so spot on and pretty intense to think about, that people are inhaling the past of war. When the war so ends, it doesn't end. People are inhaling the past of war.
That's right. War is intergenerationally violent, and active campaigns to repair from war can only help mitigate that intergenerational violence. But of course, once the bomb goes off, you can't unexplode it. And that's something that we need to think about when we're actively preventing the next one.
According to Brown University's Cost of War Project, the U.S. price tag for the post-9/11 wars is over $8 trillion. For Iraq, it's about $2 trillion. What would reparations for Iraqis and Afghans look like?
That's a great question. I don't think that's mine to claim or speak to. I think that's a question for the Iraqi public. But what I have heard from people, and certainly in my interviews as an American researcher, I have heard many, many times, you owe me reparations. Mm-hmm. So the sentiment is there, it's strong and it's clear. And what people have told me anecdotally is, look, we lived in Iraq under Saddam, things were hard, yes, he was a dictator, but what we didn't have were things like Order 81, Order 100, Order 7, these systematic orders to privatize resources and to remove the idea of a public from the government. So what this means is that all of the public infrastructure that people use to thrive, right, water, sanitation, electricity, maybe even internet access, healthcare, those have all been gutted. And to reinfuse those institutions with the capacity to actually offer people basic care is what people are asking for. But of course, there are also individual claims. As I'm doing these medical surveys, environmental health surveys, I'm going from home to home. And people can walk you around their house and show you the different kind of damages for which they would be owed a personal recompense, right? Like, for example, I met a man whose home was destroyed in 2004 by the U.S. He was never repaid. He had to rebuild the house himself with the materials he had available. It was bombed again. And then he had to build it a second time. So that's two houses. I don't know how much that costs, but I know he's owed two homes. So these are the kind of questions that are certainly worth asking and would absolutely require a general survey of damage that may not have been accounted for. I don't know what the financial value of a dead child is. And I know that this is something that came up after the Holocaust, is what is the value of lost life? Can you put a number on that? I think Wendell Berry's poem Questionnaire is a really excellent case for asking this question, not rhetorically. He ends his poem, state briefly the ideas, ideals, or hopes, the energy sources, and the kinds of security for which you would kill a child. And then name, please, the children whom you would be willing to kill. And I think we're dealing with a crisis of quantification. When we start talking about reparations, it really forces us to accept that there are some things for which we can never repay the cost.
What sort of response have you received from your research?
That's a great question. I've only finished fieldwork with my research team now. We're in the analysis mode, which means recruiting a lot of really brilliant minds to help us make sense of the numbers. So in Iraq, of course, our research effort has been well received. Everybody is very clear on the political stakes and the material stakes in their lives. I think there's been skepticism, of course, that research can ever actually transfer into actionable change in people's individual lives. This is like a huge crisis of applied research in general. And in the U.S., I haven't had much reaction yet because the research is preliminary and needs to be published. I have been a little bit concerned and surprised that my team is one of the only teams that's based in the U.S. researching this. There are many people in Europe who have a lot of concern about the environmental effects of war in Iraq. And so I have found a lot of collaboration with European scholars and Iraqi scholars, and hope to find more collaborators who are U.S. based as well.
What does that say to you?
I think that we are coming up on the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And whether people remember the facts or not, everybody, U.S. veterans, American citizens, Iraqi citizens alike, have all accepted that the war was illegal. It was without any reason or explanation. Not that war is ever justifiable, but in this case, it was exceptionally unjustifiable. And that everybody lost. This was a war for profit, and most people did not profit. Very few people actually gained anything from this war. The American public had its public resources gutted. literally tax dollars burned away in these burn pits. U.S. veterans were fighting a war they didn't believe in, that had no justice attached to it, and have been poisoned, killed. And of course, the Iraqi people have been suffering immense damages over the long haul. And it's been two decades. So I think there is a turning point here in which maybe the discussions and an engagement that's going to be happening both around the PACT Act and the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion. I have a lot of hope that people are ready to actually start taking action, reparative action, because it's not just Iraqis who are breathing the detritus of war. We are all breathing this air, and we're all breathing it in different ways, of course. But in this one way, the aftermath of warfare does affect everyone together, even if that togetherness is faulty and uneven. So I have a lot of expectation, actually, for the American public to be really active in engaging Iraqis and Afghani people and Afghan people, excuse me, in really understanding the long term climate change and social effects that have been caused by our war gluttony.
Dr. Kali Rubai is assistant professor of anthropology at Purdue University. She was recently in Fallujah with a team of doctors, epidemiologists, and environmental activists studying the effects of burn pits, bombings, displacement, and military occupation. And you can learn more about her work at yourcallradio.org. Dr. Rubai, thank you so much for your important research, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will definitely continue to cover these issues, and I hope you can share today's show, because the veteran burn pit show, issue got a lot of attention, and rightly so, but the angle about how this has affected Iraqis and Afghans who have to live with this for decades to come deserves so much more attention. So I hope you can share today's show and the articles that we discussed. You can find links at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss bills that have passed the California State Legislature. A lot of things happen first in California and then sometimes take off to other states. AB 257 would give fast food workers a seat at the table to decide wages and working conditions. SB 1137 would create buffer zones protecting homes, schools, and health centers from toxic oil and gas wells. We'll also get an update on the farm worker right to unionize bill. Governor Newsom has until September 30th to approve or veto new legislation. This is Your Call. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar.